The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about a cloaking device for earthquakes. Now, Dave, this is cloaking other objects from earthquakes, right? Not cloaking earthquakes from other objects.
No, that would be a bad thing, Rob. We wouldn't want to cloak earthquakes. We want to protect buildings from earthquakes. And the question is there a high-tech or maybe even a sci-fi way to do it? And this team's idea is to cloak buildings and houses and other objects from earthquakes.
Sci-fi is science fiction, but we're in the realm of real science here, aren't we?
Well, we are. And it turns out this idea is actually not as far-fetched as you would think. If you think of a stealth bomber, for example, this is a plane, you know, developed by the military that's very good at evading radar. And radar is basically waves. And the way the plane evades waves is it's built from special materials that are in a special configuration that the plane either absorbs or reflects these waves in a way that keeps them from bouncing back and being detected by the radar. And these researchers have proposed a similar concept for earthquakes, which, when you think about it, earthquakes are also waves. They're very powerful waves that emanate from deep within the earth.
So the cloaking wouldn't be to keep them from deflecting in a certain way, as with the airplanes, but to literally either completely absorb them or make the buildings completely invisible.
Exactly. Now, the researchers didn't actually do this in the real world. What they did was they ran some simulations. And to create their earthquake cloaking device, they simulated a series of concentric rings that were made of plastic, copper, and a few other materials. And they were arranged in a very special way. And what they did was they put this virtual device into a simulation, and they simulated earthquake waves traveling at this device. And what they saw, and you can see pictures of this on the site, is when they had a regular building in their simulation, these waves hit the building, there was a lot of distortion of the waves around the building, sort of what you would expect with an earthquake. And because these waves carry the energy of several nuclear bombs, you would see in real life what they saw in the simulation, which essentially would be the building being destroyed. But when they reran the simulation with their cloaking device, all of a sudden it seemed like the waves were passing right through the device. There was no distortion. There was nothing that they saw in the simulation that would indicate that the device even felt these waves. It was as if the device was completely invisible to these earthquake waves.
How would you implement something like this?
The idea with something like this would be that you would have your building and you would make the base of the building out of this cloaking device. And the idea would be because waves travel from deep within the earth, as they travel to the surface, they're going to hit the base of the building first. And if the base of the building is invisible to these waves, the idea would be that the building as a whole would not feel this shaking.
When do we see a prototype?
Well, even though we said that this isn't science fiction and there are, you know, relatives of this type of device out there right now, experts are still saying it's going to be a long time before we would see something like this. It still is in the virtual phase, and it's going to take a lot more work before we actually see these things on buildings and houses.
Okay. What other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from shaking to stirring, and this next story is all about how the oceans get stirred up.
Why are scientists studying the stirring of the ocean?
Well, it turns out that the oceans actually need to get stirred up to distribute all of the nutrients and heat. If you think about the ocean surface, that's getting hit with a lot of sunlight, so there's a lot of heat up there, and there's also a lot of nutrients up there.
From the phytoplankton and things like that.
Exactly. And the ocean surface is a very active place. I mean, there's a lot of turbulence, there's the tides and the waves and everything, and so you can imagine at the surface, there's a lot of this stuff is getting mixed up. But the question is, how does all this heat and the nutrients get down to the ocean depths?
So there are chemical things going on at the bottom of the ocean, and there's sunlight and plants and heat going on at the top of the ocean. The stirring then would sort of make it a mixture for those creatures living in the middle of the ocean.
Exactly. If you think about the ocean ideally should be something like a blender where everything gets distributed evenly, or at least in a way that these creatures in the middle don't miss out on the nutrients and the heat.
And don't have to travel to the top or to the bottom to get what they need.
Exactly. But there's really been a lack of an explanation for how this happens, because although you have all this activity at the surface, once you start getting further down, things seem a lot calmer. So it doesn't look like there's mixing going on. But maybe all the fish in the sea, all the motion of these fish swimming around sort of acts like a giant blender. And the motions of the fish themselves are enough to blend all of these ingredients together.
So scientists have simulated the entire ocean and filled it with simulated fish to test this?
Not exactly. They actually focused on one particular fish called the Mystygius jellyfish. It's also known as the moon jellyfish. And the reason they focused on this particular type of fish is because it's very slow moving and it's got a radial symmetry, which means it looks a bit like a wheel. So it's very easy to model the type of interactions that this jellyfish has with the water. And what the researchers did was they went into a lagoon with these jellyfish and they put some green dye right ahead of the jellyfish and had the jellyfish swim into the dye. And they could see the dye being churned around as the jellyfish swim. And you can actually see a really neat video of this with the story. Now, one jellyfish obviously isn't enough to cause massive ocean circulation, but these jellyfish travel in these giant hordes, you know, thousands upon thousands of jellyfish. And when you take into account all of those jellyfish, plus all of the other fish in the sea, the researchers speculate that you've got about 1 trillion watts of energy. This is a tremendous amount of energy. In fact, it's as much energy as the winds and the tides contribute to the ocean. So you're talking about a massive amount of mixing that can be done by these large groups of motile creatures in the ocean.
Now, if so much of this mixing then is done by these creatures, would there be sort of a positive feedback if overfishing or climate change led to the demise of these creatures?
Well, yeah, you can imagine that might be a possibility. The ocean is really dependent on all these fish for churning all of these ingredients together. And you have overfishing, so you have less fish, and there's less churning going on, and then there's less of this heat and nutrients being distributed to these fish, and you have less fish. You can imagine this snowball effect where potentially overfishing could really lead to a loss of this blender, as it were, in the world's oceans. Although that's really speculation at this point. Researchers obviously need to do a lot more work into that.
Okay. Well, last one then. What's this last story about?
Well, Rob, from creatures racing around the sea to a tree that seems to be stuck. And it's not stuck in a place, it seems to be stuck in time.
How so?
Well, this is a tree from New Zealand. It's called the lancewood tree. And the lancewood tree has a very peculiar biology. As a seedling, the tree has these brown, blotchy leaves. As it grows up to a sapling, these leaves turn into these foot-long spears that almost look like arrows in reverse. And finally, as a full adult, its leaves are very nondescript. They're the standard sort of green leaves you see on most trees. And so this is a lot of changing that this tree undergoes as it grows up.
What would be the evolutionary advantage to the tree having these features in its development?
Well, the researchers in this study came up with a very interesting hypothesis. They think the tree is defending itself from a giant flightless bird known as the moa. But there's just one problem, Rob. The moa went extinct 500 years ago, and this tree is still around and still seemingly defending itself from this bird. But, you know, before they went too far with this hypothesis, they wanted to try to show that this was actually the case.
Are there any relatives to either the tree or the moa that would help?
Great question. And indeed, the researchers found a very close relative of this tree on a chain of islands called the Chatham Islands, which are about 800 kilometers to the east of New Zealand. And the moa actually also has some relatives. It's a close relative of emus and ostriches. But for this study, they compared the tree relatives. So they compared the New Zealand tree to this Chatham tree. And the first thing they did was they looked at the seedlings of both trees. So these are, you know, very small sprouts that the tree would start out as. And they shined some light on the leaves of the seedlings. And they measured what kind of wavelength and brightness of light was reflected. And what they found with the New Zealand tree was that the light was very similar to the light that was reflected off dead leaves from the forest floor.
Prompting the moa not to bend down to eat it.
That would be the idea. The moa, you know, sees these leaves on the ground and just figures this is a dead tree and wouldn't eat them. So that's the first evidence for the moa hypothesis. And the Chatham tree did not have leaves like this. Its leaves did not resemble dead leaves. So the next thing the researchers looked at were the saplings for both trees. And this time they looked at these really spiky leaves that I talked about for the New Zealand tree. And again, the Chatham tree doesn't have this. And the researchers, what was really interesting about the spikes or the thorns on these leaves is there's a really bright coloration with them. And again, you can see this photo on the site. And the researchers suspect that this coloration was a warning to the moa saying, don't eat these leaves. Otherwise, it's going to be like swallowing an arrow. And again, the Chatham tree doesn't have that kind of adaptation. And finally, they looked at the adult trees. And with the adult trees, there really isn't much difference between the Chatham tree and the New Zealand tree. And the idea is by the time the tree grows into an adult, it's so big that the moa really isn't trying to eat it anymore. The moa is really looking for stuff more on the forest floor. And so all these adaptations, while not proof, are highly suggestive that the tree was defending itself from the moa.
Was the moa the only creature eating this type of tree?
Well, that's the idea. That's why they're so focused on the moa. The moa was really the only large herbivore on this island that really would have targeted a plant like the lancewood tree. So the idea is if the plant's defending itself from anything, it would be defending itself from the moa. But again, the moa has been gone for 500 years. So this is an example of a nice evolutionary adaptation, but one that's sort of whose time has come and gone because the plant doesn't really need to defend itself anymore.
Now, you said this was a hypothesis. What would make for a further test of this hypothesis? Why still a hypothesis at this point?
Well, Rob, we talked about earlier how the moa is related to emus and ostriches. And so one expert suggested, well, let's put emus and ostriches into this equation now and see if they are repelled by these barbed leaves and are confused by these leaves that look like dead leaves to see if perhaps the moa would have reacted in the same way.
So a test still to come.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about stressing out mice and what kind of habits stress encodes in the brain. And also a story about making brown fat. Brown fat is this type of fat that burns a lot of calories and generates a lot of heat. And researchers are trying to figure out if there's a way to use this fat therapeutically, perhaps to help people lose weight. And for the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into a story about NIH funding. Some things are changing with funding the National Institutes of Health, and we've got an item on that. And also about a series of studies relating to AIDS and prostitutes and how these studies got killed by Congress. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.